Welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Stephen Mailer about Egypt, the land of Osiris, catastrophobia, or the catastrophe many thousands of years ago now. And of course, how this has changed mankind. And we're trying to get a little bit to both how things were before that, but also the origins of the structures in Egypt, of course, that pre-dawns this catastrophe, this time here. But I want to ask you a little bit more about the word Kemet and obviously the relationship to Kemi and alchemy and all this stuff. Has there been, in your view, Stephen, a tradition in the Western esoteric world, the occult world, if you will, that actually had managed to preserve and keep some of these teachings alive through esoteric Western alchemy? What do you think, Stephen?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's this source. I was a Rosicrucian, and I had many connections to the Masons. If you see people who have been involved in any of these mystery schools, they always seem to have Egyptian symbolism, Egyptian imagery. And in fact, in my second book, From Light into Darkness, I trace the origins of the Rosicrucian Order. I was a staff research scientist for the Rosicrucian Order, AMARC, A-M-O-R-C, which stands for Ancient Mystical Order Rosicrucis, which was then in San Jose, California, in the U.S., in the late 70s, early 80s. It is no longer the world headquarters, but it was then.
I was there, by the way, Stephen. We visited there a while back. We did a little episode about it. It's an interesting park that they still have there in San Jose.
Yes, it's no longer what it once was, but I was there probably when it was at its height, in the late 70s, mm-hmm. early 80s, when it was the world headquarters. And so as being a staff research scientist and as a Rosicrucian, of course, I had access to the archives. So what I found out, and it was able that I was able to put into my second book, the Rosicrucians themselves traced their origins to the 18th dynasty of the New Kingdom of Ancient Egypt. In fact, to one particular king, and it is his face that is on the cover of my book. He had the title. He took the title Akhenaten. Many, many books have been written about him. There have been more books written about him than any other character in history, perhaps even Jesus, in only just the last 150 years, in many different languages. And so Harvey Spencer Lewis, who was the imperator of the Rosicrucian Order starting from 1915 to 1939, he wrote a series of secret essays, which can only be seen when you reached a high degree of the order, which reveals that it is one of the secrets that the Rosicrucians brought forth into the modern day is that it will be the reincarnated soul of Amenhotep IV, who was Akhenaten, who would reestablish the order in the land where the eagle spreads its wings, Harvey Spencer Lewis was originally given the jurisdiction for North and South America, where the eagle, the condor, is the symbol. So it was, these groups themselves trace themselves back to ancient Egypt. And as you said, the word itself. In fact, one of the oldest Arabic words for Egypt, it's now El Misr today, was Al-Chem, where the word alchemy comes from. So I define alchemy as being the arts and sciences of ancient Kemet. So yes, everything we have today, which we can call vibrational healing, reflexology, all the different aspects of alternative healing, sound healing, crystals healing, everything that we do today, which is called New Age or alternative, was once practiced in ancient Egypt. In fact, again, you wanted to know, we can only speculate, but I believe that when we're talking about the ancient Kemetians, they are the sources of the patriarchs in the Old Testament, in that they could live hundreds of years. Living in a society, the whole civilization was bathed in infrasound. This infrasound kept immune systems to the highest state of functioning. So therefore, viruses and bacteria, which we suffer from today, they did not. And I believe they lived hundreds of years, which is the source of the ages of the patriarchs. So that's one, and highest state of consciousness. So in other words, this was a civilization continually bathed in sound, infrasound, and viable sound. And I believe people then not only did not have a written language, which we know, but did not have a spoken language. Sound was sacred. Sound was used to raise stone, to produce anti-gravity field, to lift stone, we could discuss that, to keep healing, to cut and shape stone. Sound was used to keep healing, to keep the immune system at the highest states of function, so sound was sacred. We communicated telepathically when we were using 360 senses, and sound was only used in a sacred sense.
Very interesting. I wanted to ask you, not that you might know this, because you're not, you can't speak for Harvey Spencer Lewis, of course, but there's also a statue, I remember that, of the Roman Emperor Augustus in the park. What's the link there?
Great. Very good. Boy, I wish I had some images to put up here. That statue was moved. That statue was originally in a spot today, which this is a very interesting thing. I don't want to get too deep into this, but Harvey Spencer Lewis had some dubious contacts. At the time, he actually had some German and Italian contacts, which later became fascist, and so he was criticized for that later. So he was actually given that statue by Mussolini.
Oh, really?
When yes, in the 20s, yes, when we were establishing the Rosicrucian Order in Italy, which then, of course, Mussolini usurped, just like Hitler and the Nazis usurped the Masons and the Rosicrucians when it was but you know, the two leases, I mean, I could go on and on. The whole Nazi movement behind, that eventually became National Socialism behind Hitler, was started out as a metaphysical group.
Oh, sure,
group, sure. Called the Thule Society, right. So they were very much interested in all the spiritual things, and they just appropriated it and took it, just like Napoleon did. Napoleon declared himself the Grand Master of the Rosicrucian Order without ever being initiated. He also declared himself the head of the Masonic Order when he became Emperor of France, and he never earned those degrees. So, I mean, that's just what happens in the nature of politics. But so Harvey Spencer Lewis, I had a very close connection to him, even though he passed in 1939. I felt very deeply connected to this, and that's why I wrote about him a lot in that book. That statue was given as a gift from Mussolini. It was originally placed in a position where it was pointing to Harvey Spencer's house across the street. That statue has been moved today. It is now near the planetarium. It is not pointing at it. They now have a statue that was erected during the time I was there by a sculptor who did an Egyptian statue of Thutmose III. Thutmose III is Akhenaten's great-grandfather, is considered the traditional grand master of the Rosicrucian Order, began the teachings at around 1400 BCE, began the systems of degrees which became the Rosicrucian Order. So he's considered the first traditional founder, not the first grandmaster, he's considered the founder of the Rosicrucian Order. Akhenaten, his great-great-grandson, is considered the first grandmaster. So that's why they replaced the statue, they moved Augustus away, and they put a statue of Thutmose III. But originally there, if you had been to Rosicrucian Park in the 80s, you would have seen that statue in a location where it was pointing directly to Harvey Spencer.
Yeah, they do it a lot with statues. If you pay attention to where they're looking or pointing, there are subtle hints like that.
I could give you a whole lecture here of the symbolic imagery of Rosicrucian Park, which most people don't know about. There's so much things there. Oh, yeah. But it was, and again, if you remember, now going to Rosicrucian Park, do you remember the central fountain where it was the research building behind it, the research lab? Okay. There were two sphinxes that were seated right in front of because I worked in that Rosicrucian research lab. There were two sphinxes. The faces of the sphinx actually have Harvey Spencer Lewis.
Yeah.
And in 1939, he put in there a time capsule. He put in there something that was supposed to be opened. I think it's going to be around 2015 if they still follow through with it, to be opened for future time. He put a time capsule in there. There's a great picture that they took of that in 1939, him doing that. So the Sphinx, if you go back to Rosicrucian Park today, look at the faces of all the Sphinxes that are on the property. They're Harvey Spencer Lewis.
Ah, interesting. Yeah, and I know his son took over for a while, Ralph Maxwell Lewis, and they...
I knew him. He was there when I was there. He passed away in 2000.
87, I think I'm reading here from Wikipedia.
Right, you're right. No, you're right. Yeah. You're right. I'm not getting it right. 87. And that's when it actually broke up. And that's when it went back to France, which is now the headquarters for Europe, and Rosicrucian Park in San Jose is no longer the international headquarters.
Oh, interesting. And he was involved in Martinism a little bit as well. Are you familiar with that?
Oh, yeah. So Martinists are very, very closely tied to the Rosicrucians. Oh, yeah. From Louis-Claude de Saint-Martin, who was known as the Unknown Philosopher.
Ah, very interesting.
So, really, to answer what your general question was, I say all the mystery schools today, all the so-called esoteric schools, all the esoteric teachings came out of ancient Egypt.
Yeah,
no doubt.
A link back there to that time, to that era. Why don't we talk a little bit more about basically some of the technology, if we go back to, again, the Serapeum, and we talk a little bit about... obviously the idea that the power plant, that this era ended at the time of the catastrophe as well. Do we know specifically what actually happened, how the machine, if we can call it that, then this engineering masterpiece, actually broke down as a consequence of this?
Well, what we can show and what we show people on site, again, when we're talking pre-cataclysm and post-cataclysm, we believe we show effects of the cataclysm at the site. Now, Brian Foster does an excellent job of this in Bolivia and Peru, where he can show like walls of Sacsayhuaman or walls of Incan temples that look like they're scorched, like they're burned, like they've been melted by some great heat. Well, in Egypt, we see this too. We see evidence of some type of effect. Now, in the Great Pyramid itself, there's a tremendous amount of evidence for an explosion, for an accident inside the Great Pyramid. For example, there are cracks in the ceiling of the Grand Gallery, where it is believed that the great granite beams were thrust upward and crashed down. Something caused an effect there. The walls of the king's chamber are spreading outward an inch and a half from the floor. There's burn marks on the ceilings of the Grand Gallery. There's numerous amounts of showing of evidence of science. So we believe we actually show evidence of the cataclysm. Like if we take you on the Giza Plateau, we can show you that once behind the Sphinx, what is now known as the Valley Temple, the whole wall was once covered in granite. It is not there anymore. All the granite is on the ground, in pieces, broken up. Now, the Egyptologists will say, well, the dynastic people came in and they quarried it. Well, they quarried some of it, but they could not possibly have done what we see. They could not have taken all the casing stones off the pyramids that we see, because most of the casing stones are missing, except for the middle pyramid at the top and the bent pyramid at Dahshur, the only pyramids that still have casing stones. The Great Pyramid only has two levels of casing stones on the north face and one level of casing stones on the west face. That's it. It was totally cased. How did those casing stones come off? Well, they came off from the cataclysm. The cataclysm greatly weakened the whole Buwizer grid line from Dahshur to Abu Ruwash. All of those pyramids, that whole grid line shook, rocked violently. We can show you, take you to the bent pyramid at Dahshur, show you where the corners are blown off, and yet if they say that it was quarried, the casing stones are still on there. If they had quarried, attacked the pyramid to quarry, why did they leave the casing stones, which are supposedly the easiest stones to quarry? No, and there's still stone laying all around the pyramids. If they had, they definitely used some of these stones to build mosques in Cairo. This is true. The fortress of Saladin, which you come into, you visit, but when you come into Egypt, coming straight from the Cairo airport, the great fortress of the medieval sheikh who fought the crusades against Richard the Lionheart, they were built from pyramid stone. It's true. But there's so much stone still laying around. If they had just done all the damage we see by quarrying, there would be no stone there today. And they have to be able to explain how the so-called dynastic or even Middle European Arabs, Middle-aged Arabs, could have attacked these pyramids and removed all this granite and stuff.
Yeah.
No. The evidence is there that the damage we see was from the cataclysm, and that's what we point out. There's amazing, amazing evidence of cataclysmic damage, of again, a block of stone which could weigh 300 to 400 tons. There's even more than that, there's what is known as the Ramesseum, which is in the south near Luxor. There was once a huge statue of a seated king. The cartouche on it says it was Ramses II. It's all out of rose quartz granite. There's no way this was done during the time of Ramses II. The cartouche was just put on later. Again, this is how we say that transform the sites. They would just come from one time period, scribble on some markings, and this is how the Egyptologists date the sites, from the scribbled on markings, not from the technology that they're looking at. This structure was a seated statue of a king on a platform. It is totally on its side, totally in pieces today. Even conservative Egyptologists estimate that the total structure weighed 1,000 tons. The statue of this king, which was not Ramses, which was just an individual, was probably 300 tons of rose granite. Now, you can tell me that I can't think of any levers or pulleys or any people that could have attacked that today and pulled it on its side. It had to be a massive earthquake. And we're talking about 10 plus earthquakes that probably hit the planet during the cataclysm.
Let's go back. You talked about the five stages of the sun before, and that this was kind of a microcosm version as well of how mankind's journey has been as well. It almost seems, you know, when you're talking about this, that this is kind of, preordained. This has been it was a path that we was meant to walk, almost, that this catastrophe and the way we've been kind of, you know, knocked unconscious almost in a way, that this has been just been meant to be this way. Well, what is your view on this, Stephen?
That's a great question. You know, that's a very profound question, because you bring up a great conundrum which many, many minds have struggled over, including the great philosophers of the last couple hundred years. Is everything predestined, or do we have free will? Why does it have to be either or? I'd say both things exist at the same time. We do have free will in certain events in our life to make choice, but yet these cycles are determined, and there's no doubt about it. Again, why we brought this up is we wanted to do away with this. As we discussed in the beginning, we're returning to it again. The one paradigm of academia, which I was most against and most wanted to destroy in my first book, Land of Osiris, is this idea of Darwinian linear evolution. I don't say throw all of Darwin out. Never throw the baby out with the bathwater. But this idea that we move in a straight line from the primitive to the complex, nothing in nature works that way. Everything that we can observe moves in cycles. Cycles, always cycles. So therefore, the commissions understood that, and they created this idea of looking at the daily movement of the sun, five stages they put it at, like other people, like people have brought up. Well, in the Indian, the Vedic tradition, they talk about the yugas. There's four. So Hakim would say to somebody, well, they say four, we say five. It's the same thing. It's talking about the cycles returning continually, and so that there always will be this return, so that nothing is permanent, nothing ever stays the same. We return, but we're spiraling. We're not staying in the same position in a cycle. We're spiraling upward. All energy moves in spirals. That's why all the classic imagery you can see from the most prehistorical sites, the most earliest sites, when human beings began to scribble and make signs on rocks, on cave walls, one of the first things they drew was a spiral, because innately knowing everything moves in a spiral. So therefore, that is the basis of the cycles. The cycles are the key fundamental teaching of chemetology. It's the key fundamental to understand that we throw out this idea that we today are the great sum total of every human being that's ever existed, and therefore we're the most magnificent. In essence, again, that's both true and untrue. Yes, we are the sum total. We carry, again, according to the metaphysical tradition, I believe in, not just in our brains, but in our cells. We carry the memory of every human being that's ever lived. This is the so-called Akashic record that people can identify with. So that, yes, we are the sum total, but we're in, when I would discuss these cycles to people, and then I would say, okay, the five stages, and Amun. Amun is the stage of practice, which is characterized by polarity consciousness, by separation, by characterization of being in the low end of the cycle, maybe only using the low set. Then I would say to people, and where do you think what cycle we're in today? And most people, of course, who've been an aware audience would say, we're in that stage. Yes, this is where we differ from the linear evolution, who say, we're at the peak, we're the ultimate of humanity. No, we're in the age of Amun, coming out of Amun, going into Kheper, but we're coming out of 5,000 years of darkness. What is that characterized by? Patriarchal religions, organized warfare, separation, polarity thinking, racism, sexism, all the isms come in the last 5,000 years, where we suddenly think we concentrate on, I'm this tribe, you're that tribe. We concentrate on our differences instead of our similarity. This is what's characterized by Amun. But as Hakim would say, as you brought up with your question, no one is to blame. We have fallen out of consciousness. We have been born in the last 5,000 years with a veil over us. We come born in these last 5,000 years, with exception of certain amazing individuals who stand out in history, who are born fully aware, fully conscious. Most of us are born unconscious. We don't remember who we are. We have to find out who we are, and then we have to be led by religion, by education, by politicians to tell us who we are, instead of finding out ourselves. So, yes, it is the idea that no one is to blame. Hakim would always say that. Did humanity, again, with the myth of Atlantis, we use an imagery of there is some glyphs on the wall, in the crypts of the temple of Hathor Tendari. You have to go into the basement. You have to go into the basement because only the highest initiates would see this. This was not for everybody to see. And on the wall there is a scene which shows giant-like individuals holding what looks like giant light bulbs. And they're showing them to that. And then there is one scene where there is a creature which looks like a baboon. Some people say it looks like a reptile, holding up two knives and deflecting the beam of this light. Now, we use this imagery to show that this was the knowledge of electricity. Some people say these images are only symbolic. They're lotuses. It's not really showing. Again, I say, why does it have to be either or? Something can be both symbolic and actual at the same time. Yes, it's symbolic, but it's also showing that there was this knowledge of electricity, wired electricity, because it shows them being plugged in. But the warning is in the text, and Hakim was the only one who translated the text for the rest of us to know. The texts say that there's a warning there, that there once was a knowledge of this great energy that could be abused. We use this symbol to show that this was the myth of Atlantis, right here, because everybody coming down from Casey to Plato was saying that supposedly Atlantis had this great knowledge of energy, misused that energy, abused that energy, and then they fell because of it. So we're coming back to say that, yes, things definitely have had an effect. It's like the climate situation today. Again, it's not either or. some argument, which is getting less and less, but some argument will be, oh, this is the natural carbon cycle. We can look back at the 1850s, or even before that, where carbon dioxide was at its highest, and there was no human pollution, there was no ages, and so it's just a natural cycle. And then, of course, the majority now, on the other side, human beings are definitely involved in influencing the climate. Again, it's not either or, they're both true. This is the natural carbon cycle, but there's no doubt that human activity in the last 150 years has exacerbated the climatic change that we're seeing around the world. So it's not either or. But again, we're not to blame. If we become conscious, there's no blame. We're being ignorant. We're not aware of totally what we're doing. We're becoming more and more conscious. So instead of dealing with blame, the idea is to see that now is the time to open up and to realize what's happening, that the cycles are there, the cycles are actual, and the cycles are changing. And we're at the stage now where it's a key pivotal point human history, which again, I point to indigenous peoples all around the world, not just the indigenous peoples of Egypt, but indigenous people all around the world, the Maya, the Aztec, the Hopi, even the Tibetan, are saying we're coming to the end of great cycles now. It is time for a great shift in consciousness. This is why we're doing it.
The interpretation, obviously, of what the illusion is will differ for everyone, Stephen, but do you think that we are going to make it out of this bubble, if you will, of the illusion that we've been in terms of the fact that we've been, again, it hasn't been easy to be a human being under these conditions, if we can call it that, considering everything that's been going on. So are we going to make it out of that bubble?
I always think of Charles Dickens, who I think was an initiate. It wasn't a Rosicrucian. It was the best of times and the worst of times.
Yeah, right.
Yes, I only go by the man who was my model, my image. I never met anyone in my life like Abdel Hakim Awyan. I never met anyone who had less fear of the other side. One of the key teachings I bring out in second book, From Light into Darkness, he gave us five key teachings. Again, five. Always using the number five. First, when he met me, he said, there is no time. Time is an illusion. The past and the present are only in, the past and the future are only in this present. There was nobody I ever met in my life who lived more in the present than Hakim did, and yet he was so much a prehistorian, an archaeologist, and so much could see what the future would bring. But he said it was only time is only a function of distance, so there is no time. Then he would say there is no death. The death is just an illusion. Then he would say there is no separation. The last two that he gave me in the later years, which became the book From Light into Darkness, where there is no God and there is no soul. Those are interesting to discuss. But the idea there is no separation, which meaning that we're all connected and the cycles, there is no death. So I never met anyone in my life who had less fear of the other side than he did. And he's been more with me today, Henrik, than he was in the physical. There is not a day that goes by where he's not in contact with me, where he doesn't talk to me, where he doesn't show his presence. I feel his presence. He's just not there where I can hug him and kiss him and be there in the physical. But he's there every day. And so he, Henrik, was ultimately convinced that this was going to happen. He had no shaking, no doubt that we are coming into Cheper. We were all, it's not the end of humanity. We're not going to destroy ourselves like before. Again, I think in 11,500, less than 10% of what was the total human population survived. But look where we are today, with 8 billion of us coming from that 10%. The same would happen today. Many people may leave now. There's going to be an increase in cataclysms. There has to be. There will be, we have not yet seen the mother of tornadoes, earthquakes, tsunamis that are going to happen. It's going to happen. There are going to be more loss of life that way. Hakim would always say those people are choosing to go on that way as a lesson for those that will stay behind. And we may have another phobia. We may now have another will arise from that, but we are going to make it. I vacillate every day. I mean, I look at the news, I look at the violence, I look at the hatred, especially the violence towards women and children, which characterizes patriarchy, which certainly would have never existed in ancient Kemet. Ancient Kemet being a matriarchy, there was no such thing as an illegitimate child. Every child born of woman was legitimate. The only relationship that was known in ancient Kemet was mother and child. There was no word for father. There was no word for brother. There was no word for sister. It was only mother and child. There probably was some type of generic term, which would be like cousin, which means you were members of the same tribe, but the only relationship was mother and child. So we all were in our mother's clan and our mother's household. The matriarch would have been the oldest woman. She would have been the most respected, and history and knowledge would have been passed down that way. So we're out of balance, no doubt. But we're seeking more to head back to balance. The woman women's movement was necessary to bring women to the consciousness to realize how they've been oppressed for 5,000 years. But it's not a question of when we were in ancient Kemet, when it was matriarchy, that women were superior and men were inferior. It's not the opposite. It was not that way. Men knew their place. Men had identity. Nobody was inferior. It was a whole different way of understanding. And like I said, we don't know exactly how it was, but I'm giving you hints. Different clues come to us, and it comes to us as we raise our consciousness. As we raise our consciousness ourselves, we can know a glimpse of what it was like to exist in 360 degrees of consciousness, which was in total harmony with natural law. Total harmony with everything.
Let me ask you this, Stephen.
And it's not to say we didn't...
Go ahead, finish that thought there.
I just want to say, it's not to say that we didn't make mistakes, that we were not perfect, because we can see mistakes in the machining of the ancient commissions. So it's not without making mistakes. That's not understood, but still in the highest state of consciousness while doing it.
Very good. Now, art and writing in the pre-cataclysmic era seems to have been somewhat lesser to the extent than what it was afterwards, specifically writing in a way. How prominent was this? Because as you said, there were structures, buildings, statues, etc., that didn't have any scribble to identify them. It was just later that I come along and people marked it, they tagged it, kind of thing. So what happened there?
I Egyptology, academia, says there was no formal system of writing before around 4000 BCE, and they relate it as being the Sumerian cuneiform. They think actually predated the glyphs, which is nonsense. We know that Sumer was just a part of Kemet. Hakim called it Samera. Samera. So the cuneiform was just a shorthand to the glyphs. The glyphs were original. I can trace the origins of the Egyptian glyph, which we call the Suf language, to around 6000 BCE. It happens to be the astrological age of Gemini, which is the age that rules writing. So around, but before then, before 6000, in other words, Henrik, I'm saying before 8000 years ago, we can find no formal system of writing existing on any human being. So, pre-cataclysm, no writing.
Was there no need for it, or how do we explain that?
Exactly. I explain the origin of writing, coming from the fact of the waning of the senses. So the origin of writing would have been post-cataclysmic, would have been during the time of fear, would have been time during the collective phobia. People are starting to lose their senses. They're starting to lose the ability to telepath. There were those certain individuals. We can call them the early shaman. They later became the priests. We use the term Hanut. I can explain that in more detail because it has to do with the origin of religion. But as far as writing goes, there were those individuals who used certain techniques, whether it was breathing techniques, yoga like we use today, or the discovery of psychoactive plants, whatever it was, they used certain techniques to keep themselves in that high state of consciousness while the people were waning. They invented a system of signs, of just symbols to teach, to try to keep the knowledge going. So symbols would have been first invented to try to replace the losing telepathic. So they would try to show you a symbol, try to see if you could understand what that symbol represented. And then eventually those symbols became a spoken language. A sound would come associated with the symbol, that sound would become the spoken language. So the original language was for education, was to illuminate, was to try to keep people in the highest state of consciousness, but it very early became corrupted and became a system of the temple of the early religion to just keep taxes, to just keep inventory of the goods.
Well, exactly, because that's a lot what...
For business. Yeah. So there it is then. Writing really becomes a function of business.
That's right. That's what we see coming out from Sumer. If you look at a lot of the early, it's like it's a registry in some cases. You know, it's lists of what, you know, what is there or not. It's like inventory and stuff like that. It's kind of...
You're exactly right. Some of the oldest papyruses we have found from temples have been just inventories of the goods of the temple.
It seems like this has to do with the fact that there is, what if there's a loss of memory or something almost at that point, that they discovered that there's a need to externally to try to, you know, pin this down because it'll be lost otherwise.
So that's why I titled the second book From Light into Darkness. People look at that and say, no, isn't it the opposite? Shouldn't it be from darkness into light? We've come from these pagan religions, polytheism, into Christianity, Judaism, Christianity. Aren't we? No. It's the other way. The idea is exactly right. What you're talking about is then it became a concentration on the physical. the material instead of the spiritual.
And also, Stephen, that is obviously understandable if the properties of our existence has changed at that point, that that's the only thing that we potentially can resort to try to, you know, stabilize the degradation, if you will, right?
I agree. And it sometimes sounds like I'm putting a value judgment, which is me, unfortunately, but you're right. There's no value. It should be no value judgment. It just what was necessary at the time. You're right, for function.
Yeah. Tell us more about Hanut and the origin of religion that you mentioned
briefly. Hey, well, this is a beautiful story that Hakim tells us. No one else does. The word Hanut, it originally meant funerary priest. So how does religion begin? Well, here we are again. We're at this time of a post-cataclysm where the consciousness is starting to wane. Now, what used to be, there used to be certain areas which were sacred spots. Like Hakim tells us, before she was carved into the head of the Sphinx, what is there today was a limestone outcropping. In other words, only what we today see today as the head of the Sphinx would be sitting above the plateau. The level of the plateau of the Sphinx is just where the head is today. So where the body is, of course, that was all carved out. All those blocks were taken out for the body of the Sphinx and made the temples in front of it. The Sphinx Temple and the Valley Temple were made from that. But originally it would just be a yardang, just a limestone outcropping. Well, Hakim tells us that tradition says, even as late as 56,000 years ago, people came there just to energize themselves, because it is a power place. There is running water, there is crystal, produces an energy field. People feel energized. Well, originally, what he said, the original power place would be two stones. They probably were meteorites, some type of extraterrestrial stone that had tremendous energy. The stones were placed next to each other with a stream of running water going underneath it. This would produce a powerful electromagnetic energy field. People would go there, and they would energize themselves. Well, one day, as the senses are starting to wane, these people who we now call the Hanut would get together and say, look, the people are losing it. They're losing their consciousness. They're losing their connection to this. We have this. We can keep this ourselves through the techniques we do, through the facilities we have. Why don't we do something like this? And what they did is they drew a line in front of the block. And they told the people, you have to stand behind the line. Because we, now we're calling ourselves somebody special. We later call ourselves priests. Hanut, we have connection to the divine. We can do this for you. You guys stand in line, we'll come for you, we'll speak to the divine. And the people were waning. They were losing their consciousness. They started to question these and say, oh, well, maybe you're right. And as Hakim would say, they would gladly stand in line and give a piece of bread, a piece of gold, whatever what was considered value at that time, to stand in line. This is how religion began. Because then how he explains how the temple was built. That line, later they would push back and two pylons were erected. They had to stand behind the pylon. Then there'd be a gate, a hall, what's called a hip-style hall, would be constructed. Then there'd be a gate. Then there'd be another gate, and that's how your temple was built. So eventually, all throughout dynastic Egypt, the common people didn't even come inside the temple. Only on certain days of the year, which were called the feast days, were people allowed into the courtyard. Only the priests then would be in the Holy of Holies in there making it. So that's how religion began. So these were the Hanut, originally called the funerary priests, and later they went to the farmers. And they would say to those who, we would call them farmers, so people who were growing food, who specialized in growing food. And they would say, do you ever wonder what happens to this? Pointing to the body, to the physical, when we drop it. We know we drop it. You know, we're taught that spirit goes on. But have you ever wondered what happened to this thing? Before then, they didn't care. People asked, what did they do with the bodies in ancient Kemet? They did like the Tibetans do today. They probably broke the bones and left them out for scavengers. They didn't care about the body. The body was nothing to them. They had no funerary practices whatsoever in ancient Kemet. So here these priests come along and they tell the farmers, we'll take care of that. If you're worried about it, all you have to do is give us 25% of your harvest to the temple each year, and we'll prayers, we'll set up magic spells, we'll make sure you can come back to this body. That's how mummification began. That's how religion began. It began as the funerary priest. But we actually labeled it term Hanuti today, or Hanut, as anyone who exploits another human being, or exploits any other life form for their own benefit.
Well, that sounds like the origin of government right there, too.
That's the point. That's the point.
Yeah.
And then, so here's another thing which is incredible. One day I was talking to him, and I was mentioning the word, you know, so-and-so. So I was talking about some of the politics going on with Mubarak, and I'd say, so-and-so is in cahoots with Mubarak. He'd say, Stephen, do you know the origin of that word? And I'd say, no. He said, originally that word is kahana. It meant to be in alignment with the Hanuti. That's the word kahoot. To be in cahoots with them.
Interesting. Yeah, I see.
only Abdel Hakim would
teach that. Now, I wanted to ask you a couple other things here about, well, I wanted to tie in the Hyksos as well, the nature of the Hyksos, if they were, in your view, if they were invaders and conquerors that destroyed things, if you will, in their wake, or did they bring in and changed and reform Egypt in a good way? Well, how do you view the Hyksos?
Totally different, and it's written by anybody else. And again, this is how Hakim characterized. What is traditionally talked about in Egyptology, they believe the Hyksos were Semitic tribes who invaded Egypt right around the end of the Old Kingdom to the Middle Kingdom, around 1600 BCE. And a lot of the so-called names, the titles of the rulers then, were Semitic titles. So it's believed by a lot of them that these were the origins of the Hebrews, and these eventually became the Hebrews, and they eventually left were hated by the indigenous Egyptians and left as far as the Exodus. None of that is true that we believe. Hyksos is a Greek word. Again, Hakim was a master at going to the origin of the word, to go to the root to find out what it meant. The word is hek-a-os word in the Kemetian language. And hek-a-o means those that work with sacred sound. So Hakim said, totally different than anyone else has taught, for anybody that's listening and has read it, and this is in my second book, this is in From Light into Dark, that the Hyksos were originally tribes, Kemetians. They were not Semites, they were not different than other Kemetians. They lived in the south, but they did not take part in the political games of a lot of the other tribes in the south. So then that there was a fight for power at the end of the so-called Second Dominion period, a powerful group of family arises in the south, which becomes the 18th dynasty, so-called dynastic period. Hyksos did not support them. So later, they're talked about as being enemies, as being invaders, as being outcasts, especially the later dynasty that comes after it, the 19th dynasty, links them to the Exodus. And it's not true. And the fact is, they were not Semites. Some of them may have taken Semitic titles, but Semites and Kemetians were not separate. They were the same people. People in Syria today, in Jordan today, were part of Kemet. So Semites were part of Kemetians. They were not considered anything different. And interestingly enough, Hakim is the only one that goes by the title Kaswert, Hek-Kaswert, which where Hyksos comes from, with those who use sacred sound. He said the original Hyksos were tribes who lived in the Sinai and were geologists who used sound to extract precious metals. And at one time were very important to the Kemetian civilization. But because they did not get involved in the political dynamics of the tribes in the south, they were considered outcasts. The ruling party comes in, you didn't back the ruling party, so you're the enemy then. So then they can consider this history that's put about them comes out in the later dynasty, the 19th dynasty, that they were invaders, that they were usurpers, that they had to be beaten, that the tribes in the south had to gather together and beat them off and win. It wasn't that way at all. But again, we're the only ones that say that.
Oh, yeah, interesting. So who was involved in the Exodus and that whole story and the Egyptian roots, potential Egyptian roots of Judaism, etc.?
It goes back to our man, Akhenaten. That's why I say, why my book, From Light into Darkness, I have at least five chapters on Akhenaten. I link him not only to the Rosicrucian teaching, but to Judaism. So what we say the Exodus was, and this is what Hakim agreed with me, why he agreed to work with me on that book, because this was his belief, his understanding too, that what the Exodus was the Amun priests chasing the followers of Akhenaten, the Akhenites, out of Egypt. And we can document it on the wall of a temple in the south. There is a temple in the south which is known as the Ramesseum. It was originally called the Temple of Time and Timelessness. It shows reliefs on the wall that were made during the 19th dynasty, right the period after the Exodus, that shows opposite. It shows the enemies of the armies of Amun, the Akhenites, being scattered, beheaded, being thrown, like destroyed in the flood, like the Red Sea closing around them. The opposite story. Here it's the supposedly the Hebrews, or it's the Akhenites who are drowning in the Red Sea. And this is, as Hakim would say, these reliefs show the Exodus from the Egypt side. It shows the Amun priests being victorious over the armies of Akhenaten and chasing them out of Egypt. That was the Exodus, without a doubt.
Very interesting. How do you interpret then history? Because as we know, history is usually written by the victors. I mean, it's like trying to go to Julius Caesar to read, and get some accuracy when it comes to, the Celts, for example, which is a very, bad idea to do, considering, that it's propaganda going on in the writing as well. And wouldn't this include, scenes on a temple and stuff like that?
Well, they're right, Henrik. You're so right on. Again, you've hit the point of what I try to talk to people a lot to explain the meaning of writing, to understand how writing was used. And the majority of time in our history, writing has been used for propaganda, to lead people astray, not to illuminate. And again, as an indigenous wisdom teacher, Hakim had that bias. When people would start talking about, oh, we need to find the older text, we need to find the older text, Hakim would stop and say, if it had to be written down, it is not the whole truth. That is the bias of the oral tradition. So yes, writing was mostly used for propaganda. Let me give you a quick one here. This is, again, a video that people can see on Brian's site. I give a teaching. It's exactly what we're talking about. I tell people, you have to know where the writing is located in a temple to understand what it is saying, what it means. In other words, the writings in the Holy of Holies, in the crypts, like I say, they would be for the highest mission. They would be the secret teaching, the esoteric wisdom. That's the only time. But the writings on the outside walls for the people to see, that was propaganda. Even though the people couldn't read the writing, the priests would read the writing to them and tell them. So yes, it was propaganda. The classic example is on the outside walls of the temple at Karnak. It shows the walls, a battle which is known as the classic battle of Kadesh. It was put on by the priests of Ramses II. This was a battle between the Hittites and the Egyptians. What it's showing, the text is saying on the walls outside the temple, for only the people to know, as the priest tells them, that the Egyptian armies won the battle, that the armies of Ra, led by Ramses II, scattered the Hittite armies to the wind. They were victorious. They were wonderful. And then I said, but you know what? When archaeologists go to the Hittite capital of Hattusis, they find the same battle on the wall there, but there's the Hittite king who wins the battle. He spread the Egyptian army is going to win. So what is the truth? Well, the truth is now is the historians and Egyptologists have gathered the evidence and they believe the battle was a draw. The battle was a draw, which led to the first peace treaty in history. So then, quickly, I tell everybody a little story. There was a great American movie called The Devil and Daniel Webster. It was about the American Revolution. It was produced, I think, in 1957. The great British actor Sir Laurence Olivier played General Cornwallis. The end of the movie, it is obvious that the great British Empire has been defeated by this ragtag, sloppy guerrilla army of colonists. And what will history say? And that's exactly the scene is Cornwallis's aide-de-camp comes to him and says to him, but General, what will history say? And the great Sir Larry, without missing a beat, says, history, sir, will lie. And then I point to the glyphs on my major point is, Henrik, so many people get obsessed with understanding the Egyptian glyphs, which having to learn the hieroglyphs, it's so important. That's going to lock all the history. We're going to know the truth, but we're going to know the glyphs. And that's nonsense. The majority of the Egyptian glyphs are propaganda, were stories just told for some priest to flatter some wealthy person who's giving them the money to build their tomb for them and say, oh, we're going to do this for you, and you're going to meet Osiris, and you're going to do that. All these magical spells, they're all propaganda. The real wisdom was kept secretly in oral tradition. It's what became the Kabbalah. The original meaning of the word Kabbalah, Ka-ba-la, is a Kemetian term. It means a teaching which reaffirms that we are spirit more than body. That's what Kabbalah means, and it was originally the oral teachings of Egypt, handed down to Moses. Even in Judaism, in Orthodox Judaism, the esoteric teaching is that the Kabbalah was whatever Moses left out of writing down. What he didn't write down, of course, he didn't write anything. We know that. But Judaic story is Moses wrote the five books, and whatever he didn't put in the books, he talked orally to the priest that would become the priest, and that became Kabbalah. So Kabbalah is the oral tradition.
Answer me this then, Stephen. The consequent writing that we get out from Judaism with the Torah and the Talmud and all these things, and then leading into the Bible later on as well, how do you view that writing? Is that part of the propaganda as well?
Of course. That is where I get into trouble, where I have to say, oh, I'm not here to offend anybody's religion. But of course, if Hakim is saying, if it had to be written down, it's not the whole truth, then the Bible, the Quran, are only partial truths. Not to say there are not truths there. There's not to say there's not esoteric wisdom there.
Sure.
There's not to say there is spiritual. Yes, but they were mainly written for propaganda. The Old Testament was written to define the Jewish people, to give an identity to a people, to use all the previous texts, and it's quite obvious because I can do that with the Old Testament. I can show where it comes from Egyptian sources. I can show where it comes from Babylonian sources. I can show where it comes from other Semitic sources, where what was the Old Testament was just all the great wisdom teachings that were around in the day, the written books were all pieced together, glued together in what became the Old Testament. And in fact, you can even see, and other scholars have done this, not me, many books have been written on this, where the Old Testament is at least three distinct sources.
So we're talking about truth in history, and of course mythology is another layer to the storytelling and to get to the accuracy of the history. But Hakim, in regards to him, did he know how far back the oral tradition actually went and the source where this was coming from? What did he know about that?
Well, he only knew that in his tribe, which is called the Awiani tribe, the Ai tribe, it was his tribe's responsibility to have the history of other tribes. Certain tribes would only have the history of their own tribe. Their tribe specialized in the history of all tribes. So it was a tradition in his family for generations. How long it goes back, I mean, it obviously has to go back to dynastic time period. Has to. So I believe it's something that I think in the very early days when writing was formulated, there was the oral tradition, and the oral tradition became the Kabbalistic tradition. Came down through dynastic Egypt, came into Judaism, and it's what is esoteric Christianity, and even esoteric Islam today. The Sufis are the ones who contain esoteric Islam today. They were the original ones who kept the meanings of the symbol. The word Suf existed before Islam. The original Sufis were the ones who kept the original meanings of the symbol. So the Sufis now are amalgamated into Islam, but they are the same. It's the same. Kabbalah in Judaism, the esoteric tradition in Christianity, it exists through the religion, but it is the esoteric, not the exoteric. The exoteric is pure propaganda to get people to follow a system of beliefs so they can be controlled.
And to war with each other, because that's where it's going. They've been fighting with each other for eternity, and it seems to be just going and going and going.
And the war is amazing. It's just like I pointed out to somebody the other day, most Muslims have been killed in the last 1,300 years by other Muslims, not by Christians, not by Jews, not by non-Muslims. If you think of 1,300 years, the Sunni and the Shia have been at war. I mean, that's absurd. How could they both say they're Muslims and worshiping the same God, and it's okay to kill each other?
It's just what Christianity went through with Protestantism and Catholicism, you know? So
exactly.
This internal division that seems to be going on in all things, I think it's an internal dialectic to actually turn people against each other and to decimate, you know, cultures, etc. But that, you know, that's another story. But what I'm getting to is the same.
It is the prime function of the Age of Amun: separation, polarity. So there has to be an other. There has to be an us, and there has to be a them. It is a prime function of the age we're in. So every religion has focused on that. Every religion that's occurred the last 5,000 years has an us and a them.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you briefly if you've heard about the, what they call etchings. It's artwork. It's said to be some of Egypt's oldest known art, about 15,000 years or so, in Kurta. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correct. It's about 400 miles south of Cairo.
Yes.
And it looks, when you compare the art, it's like the similarity with the Lascaux caves in France and Spain and other regions is like striking. Have you seen this art?
No, you've given me something I probably need to focus on.
I need to send you this article then. We published this. Well, this is about 2007, time ago.
In that vein, there are what are known as the Flower of Life at the Temple of the Osirion, which is behind the Temple of Osiris at Abydos. There are on the walls illustrations of geometric symbols in red ochre paint. It's called the Flower of Life, which John Belova Melchizedek talks about. There are those that say that those marks are etched on, that they were etched on with a laser. They are not. This is red ochre paint. Promoting that is wrong. But there may have been etchings done in dynastic or ancient Egypt using heat sources to make artwork, and that's possible. I would have to investigate it fully myself to be able to speak to you authoritatively about it. When you talk about those caves, part of what I did in my background is that I did archaeology in the south of France in the summer of 1974. Besides Hakim, one of the other great teachers in my life was the late Professor Francois Bord of the University of Bordeaux, who was one of the great prehistorians, archaeologists, geologists of the 20th century.
Yeah.
He taught me field archaeology, and I saw some of those paintings. So I'm familiar with that artwork of that era, what's called the Upper Paleolithic. So I would love to see that.
Yeah, I think there's a relationship there. That's why I brought it up. And I'll send it your way and see what you think about it. It's pretty interesting. And there's bound to be done some work on that in the last few years, because this article was from 2007, so it's probably been more added to that from since that time. But Stephen, I think this is a great time to begin to wrap things up for this time. I mean, again, I want to plug the books, of course, that we've been talking about, Land of Osiris, from light into darkness. These are the ones, and as you said, you've basically authored these together with Hakim, correct?
Yes, even though his name doesn't appear on it, it is his teachings. It was his his overseeing that he had to prove everything. It was in there, of course, because he was basically, as I say, always skeptical of the written word. There were only very few books he ever endorsed. He endorsed my books, of course, and Chris Dunn's books, but very other books in Egyptology. People would say, should I read this book? Should I read that book? He would say no. So he didn't endorse too many written books. But yes, they're both on Adventures Unlimited Press. And again, we want to talk about the Kemet School of Ancient Mysticism. If people just Google that, they can find it at www.kemetology.com. We want your Red Ice listeners to know that we are doing another tour. It will be March 30th to April 12th, 2014. It is not listed on the site yet. It will be soon. As soon as we get the pricing, we'll feature myself, Brian Foster, and Gary Evans. Chris Dunn won't be with us this time, but we're going to have engineers. And again, it's going to be comparing the sites of Peru and Bolivia with Brian, doing the sacred sound with Gary, and myself and Yusuf showing site transformation of all the sites in Kemet. So again, we're going to be doing this tour with Brian Foster, which will be wonderful, in 2014.
Very good. Kemetology.com, that's the website. Thank you so much for your time today, Stephen. Much appreciated. Thanks for talking about some of your work with us here today.
And thank you, Henrik, and bless you for the work that you do.
And as we begin to wrap things up for this time, I just want to extend my thanks to all of our members out there for listening and, of course, for your interest. We'll be back with more in just a few days. I hope you have a great weekend, and we will talk to you soon. So take good care of yourself. Bye-bye.